I tiptoed to the front of the house. At the door, I stretched up to look into the peephole. There stood the neighbor who lived on the other side of our two-family house, a squat middle-aged woman who had never been friendly to us. Leaving the safety chain hooked, I opened the door only wide enough to see out. "It's me, Diane," she said. "Unlock the door." My hands quivered as I slid the chain left and unlatched it. With my face flushed and my stomach churning, I stepped into the vestibule. The woman stared at me like I had three eyes. "Your parents have been taken," she said glibly, as if she was reporting the weather forecast.
What?
I blustered. My head felt like it was about to fall off my shoulders, tumble to the ground, and burst open right there in front of her.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, the immigration officers came here and arrested them," she shot back. "They're gone." I glared at her, all of a sudden feeling dizzy. The foyer began to spin faster and faster, as if I was stuck in a washing machine.
"No!"
I wailed. With my palms over my temples, I swayed forward, then back, and caught myself before falling onto the linoleum.
"They're not gone!"
I squealed. The woman didn't blink.
"Anyone you want me to call?"
she asked. I was too distraught to answer. My moans turned into howls.
"Well," she said, realizing I wasn't going to respond. "Let me know if you need anything, okay?"
I didn't answer. I staggered into the house and slammed the door. What am I going to do? My thoughts raced faster than my heartbeat. I need to call someone. I hurried to the living room and grabbed our cordless from its base. I dialed the number of my niece's mother, Gloria. "Ring, ring, ring," she picked up.
"Hello, Gloria?" I whimpered.
She paused. "What's wrong, Diane?"
"My parents have been taken,"
I shouted into the receiver. Hot tears escaped from my lids and splashed onto my t-shirt.
"What are you talking about?" she asked. "The police came here and arrested them," I hollered. Dead silence.
Even in my hysteria, I was already trying to find a way to fix things, to line up a new life for myself.
"Can I stay with you?" I asked between gasps.
"Maybe you can move in here. I can watch Erica for you. I'll go to school and I'll get a job." She sighed. "Diane, that's not a good idea," she said. "I don't think that would work." I heard what she said, but I couldn't quite comprehend what it meant for me.
"So what am I supposed to do?" I sniveled.
"For now," she said, "don't open your door for anyone. You don't really know what's happening yet. The police might return there. Stay out of sight until we can figure something out." Beyond terrified, I scurried back to the front door to be positive it was chained and bolted. I turned off every light, closed all the blinds, went into my room, and locked the door. With the cordless in hand, I got on the floor and scooted all the way under my bed. Our house had never felt more quiet or scary. I cried as softly as I could, my dad's words reverberating in my head. "If anything ever happens to us," he often told me, "you've gotta be strong." But I didn't feel strong. I felt weak and abandoned. I put the phone's dial pad right up to my eyes so I could see the digits in the dark. I called another lifeline, Amelia, the mother of my friend Gabriella.
"Amelia?" I whispered.
She picked up on my distress.
"What's going on, sweetie?" she asked.
In hushed tones, I told Amelia all that had happened, from my discovery that Mommy and Papi were gone.
"Where are you?" she asked.
"Under my bed." "Stay where you are," she told me. "Don't move. I'll be there as soon as I can." Minutes later, the phone rang. I saw Amelia's name on the caller ID and picked up on the first ring. "It's me, Diane," she said on her cell. "I'm here. You can let me in." At the door, I looked through the peephole to confirm it was Amelia and not the police.
After opening the door, I fell right into her arms. Gabby was there too. "It's okay, Diane," she repeated as she stroked my hair. "Everything's going to be fine now. Gabby, go make some tea." The phone rang again. It was my father. "Hector?" she said. "Yeah, I'm here with Diane." I listened intently to Amelia's side of the conversation and pieced together how the day had unfolded. My parents had been taken separately. Mommy, who'd been making dinner, was arrested in the late afternoon while Papi was on his way home from work. My father pulled into the driveway to discover that the immigration officers had surrounded the house. They were waiting to put him in handcuffs. Papi was driven to a facility for men, Mommy to one for women. My father was allowed to make one short call. This was it. Amelia, shaking her head in sorrow at what she had heard, handed the phone to me. "Your father wants to speak to you," she said. I pressed the receiver to my ear. "Papi," I said with a scratchy voice, "where are you?" "Listen to me, Diane," he said sternly. "Don't be afraid. You're a smart girl." My eyes filled with a fresh round of tears. "Don't cry, Diane. Do not cry. Now I need you to pay attention," he continued. "Because I don't have much longer on the phone, go in our room and pack our suitcases, one for me and one for your mother. We'll need some of our things in Colombia." "What?" I shrieked. Mommy and Papi had been in prison for less than 24 hours, yet my father was convinced they'd be deported. "But can't we do something to stop this?" I pushed. "There's nothing we can do," he said matter-of-factly. "The only way he and Mommy might have a chance of staying," he explained, "was if a top-level attorney took their case. Even with Papi's stroke of fortune, he didn't have money for a pricey lawyer." "I asked Amelia if you can stay with her," he told me. I heard a guard ordering Papi to finish his call. "So you'll be with her, okay? I love you. I gotta go now." Click. I put down the phone and I sat there helpless. A while later, I pulled myself together so I could complete the task Papi had given me. Amelia made some calls to her family while I slipped into my parents' room to pack. I scooted a ladder to their closet, climbed atop, and steadied myself. I carefully slid their bags from the shelf above. I threw the bags onto a nearby bed and stepped down. I had no clue where to begin. What the heck do you pack for two people who'll never return? I searched through their drawers and closet, pulling out random items. A lot of t-shirts, pants, several pairs of shoes, and a couple of coats and sweaters. Done. As I zipped the bags, I heard something. I peeked out at the door into the hall. The commotion was coming from the kitchen. I made my way there. When I reached the doorway, two men and three women, all neighbors from our street, peered at me. Word about my parents' capture had apparently gotten out. Amelia had let in the neighbors, thinking they'd come by to offer me their sympathies. What happened instead still pains me. "What are you doing?" I asked one of the women. She was standing in front of our open fridge with a large plastic bag in her hand. It appeared she'd been packing up our fruits and vegetables. "Your parents won't need this food anymore," she snapped. "We might as well take it." Before I could respond, Amelia walked in. "Excuse me," she said to the woman. "Can you please put that back and leave?" The lady glared at her and slammed the fridge without returning the food she'd stolen. I was dumbfounded. I was already feeling so vulnerable, and the people my parents had called their friends were looting their home. It was the ultimate insult. And ironically, it was at that moment, one with others surrounding me, that I felt most alone. In an effort to guard our remaining possessions, I marched from the kitchen and locked every door in the house. With my parents' suitcases stuffed, I needed to prepare a bag for myself. I didn't know when I'd return to the house, or if I would. When everything you've known has just crumbled. Nothing seems certain. I packed plenty of school clothes, my books, and a Norma Jean mini Cabbage Patch doll that Bobby had given me for Christmas. When I went into the bathroom to gather my toiletries, more tears flowed. It was like I had crying Tourette's. All around me there were signs of what my parents thought would be an ordinary evening. Mommy's rosary hanging from the towel rack, Bobby's cotton balls that he'd stuffed into his ears before he showered. I opened the medicine cabinet, took out my toothbrush, and shut the glass again. There, in the mirror, I gazed at a face I didn't know. Puffy eyes, numb lips, raw. Amelia tapped on the bathroom door. "You all right, hon?" she asked. "I'll be out in a sec," I told her. Once we dragged the suitcases to her Camry, we did a final walkthrough of the house to secure it. In the living room, I looked to be sure that I wasn't leaving behind anything I'd need. On the way out the door, I retrieved the spare key that we had hidden under our mat. "I should probably take this," I said. Amelia nodded. Just before we got in the car, Gloria drove up. She got out, ran over to me, and we hugged. Amelia told her she'd heard from Papi. "She'll stay with me for now," Amelia told her. "I'll look after her." Gloria thanked her, and we parted. Amelia's home in Rosendale was only 10 minutes from us. She shared a small house with her son and two daughters. Gabriella was the youngest. My best friend helped me lug my bags into the bedroom we'd share. Because I'd spent so much time at Gabriela's, it thankfully felt familiar, comfortable, safe. Amelia also did all she could to welcome me. "Here you are," she said, giving me fresh linens and towels. "Make yourself at home." After showering and putting on my PJs, I just called my aunt and uncle in New Jersey. In utter disbelief, they listened as I recounted the day's horrors. "What are you going to do?" my Aunt Millie asked. "Well," I said, "I'm going to stay here for now." Papi asked Amelia if I could. Only hours had passed since my parents had been detained, yet I'd already resolved something in my heart. I would not leave Boston. I would not throw away the miracle that I'd been given to attend Boston Arts Academy. Getting into that school had been the greatest thing that had ever happened to me, and I was not willing to give it up. Whatever I needed to do to stay, I was ready to do that and more. That evening in the dark, with Norma Jean by my side, I stared up at the ceiling from my twin bed. I thought of how the week had begun with Mommy's bizarre dream. I thought about my father's exuberance, the delight that spread across his face upon winning the money. I thought of the thousands of moments, large and small, that had led me to this house, this bed, this life. I tried not to cry because I didn't want to wake Gabriela, but I couldn't help it. She heard me sniffling and sat up. "You scared?" she asked. "Yes," I answered. "I know," she said. "What you're going through is scary." A wave of comfort washed over me. My friend hadn't urged me to stay strong. She hadn't told me to stand tall and to soldier on. She hadn't uttered the shallow reassurance that I'd get through this. Rather, she'd given me the permission, right before sleep, to be the frightened little girl that I was. The morning after the nightmare, I opened my eyes and looked around slowly. Where am I? And then, all at once, the horrible memory of the day before came flooding back. Yes, I thought. It really happened. I went to school that day. Amelia, a nurse's assistant, dropped me and Gabby off on her way to work. I was physically present, but my head was on another planet. I basically sleepwalked through my classes and tried to forget the devastation, to tuck it away behind some secret door of my heart. As out of it as I was glad I'd come to campus. Being there was a distraction from the trauma, and with Springfest on the way, I didn't want to miss rehearsal. That afternoon during chorus, Mr. Stewart sensed something was off with me. "You okay?" he asked. I nodded and I mustered a fake smile. He likely knew I was hiding something, but he didn't pry. I was as humiliated as I was heartbroken. Now, years later, some of my former high school classmates have said to me, I had no idea you were going through that. You didn't talk about it. Exactly. The last thing in the world I'd ever do was talk about it. What child wants the world to know that her parents have been forced into custody and thrown into a detention center? It was mortifying. Over the next week, I had short conversations with Mommy and Papi. The calls were all the same, tears, a string of apologies from both, instructions on what to do, who to call. I was exhausted, and I just wanted to be a kid. They'd each been appointed lawyers, but as they suspected, their chances of remaining here were minuscule. Because my parents couldn't speak to each other from their facilities, I became their go-between. How's your mother holding up? Papi asked. Okay, I guess, I told him. Not sure how to answer that question. I wasn't exactly taking notes on Mommy's emotional state with my own in such shambles. Has anyone from immigration tried to contact you? My father asked. No, I told him. Not only had U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement been silent, I also hadn't received a call from Massachusetts Child Protective Services. At 14, I'd been left on my own, literally. When the authorities made the choice to detain my parents, no one bothered to check that a young girl, a minor, a citizen of this country would be left without a family. Without a home, without a way to move forward. I'm fortunate that Amelia agreed to take me in temporarily, but no one in our government was aware that she'd done so. In the eyes of ICE, it was as if I didn't exist. I'd been invisible to them. 2 weeks after my parents were sent to prison, I received word that I could visit Papi. By then, both he and Mommy had been transferred from jails in Boston to detention centers in New Hampshire. One part of me longed to see my father, but another part, the part that needed some distance from the whole ordeal, dreaded the visit. Amelia drove us there. How about a little music, she offered, trying to lighten the mood during our 2-hour trip. No thanks, I muttered. Along the highway, I brightened up upon spotting a Wendy's billboard. Can we get some lunch there? I asked Amelia. Of course, she said. I had fond memories of going to that restaurant with my dad as a kid. I loved the Frosty Shake, the chicken nuggets with all those sauces, the red and yellow walls and tables. Our stop brought me a little consolation ahead of what I was about to face. We at last reached the prison, a set of brown brick buildings in the middle of nowhere. Barbed wire fence surrounded the facility. We drove through the few security checkpoints, including one with barking Dobermans. I couldn't believe that Papi, a man who'd never jaywalked or run a red light, had found himself in a place like this. Inside, our purses were thoroughly searched. A guard instructed us on a list of visitation rules. No articles or gifts, for instance, were to be directly given to the inmates. Once we made it through the metal detectors, we dropped off the suitcase I packed for Papi. We were then led to a large windowless area where about 50 others were waiting. I scanned the room. A few people were alone. Others were in groups. Some had small children with them. All were there for the same reason I was, to spend a few minutes with someone whose status was up in the air. A thin blonde guy, another guard, addressed those assembled.
"The inmates will be escorted here shortly," he announced. "Please remember to observe the facility regulations. Any violation may result in the future suspension of visitation privileges."
Amelia and I locked eyes. The door opened at the room's side. In single file behind two guards, the male prisoners entered. All wore orange jumpsuits. Amelia and I rose in anticipation of finding Papi. One prisoner. Two. Seven. Ten.
Inmate after inmate emerged. But we didn't see my father. Others were hugging their loved ones and settling into talk as we continued to wait. At last, after about 30 men had come in, I spotted Puppy. He noticed us, and with his face down, he shuffled in our direction. I hardly recognized my father. His chin and neck were covered in stubble, his hair unkempt, his teeth yellow. He'd lost at least 15 pounds. Months before, in that lawyer's empty office, I'd seen my father at his most powerless. This was worse. In his eyes, I saw the look of defeat, despair, resignation. We hugged. "Forgive me," he told me once he'd let me go. "I don't have any toothpaste here." My father, so meticulous about his hygiene, was self-conscious about his breath and appearance. He cupped his hand over his mouth in shame. I glanced around nervously, unsure of what to say. "How are you, hija?" Bobby asked to break the ice. I started to cry. "Don't cry," he told me. I could tell he wanted to hug me, but he couldn't. One of the rules was limited contact. "We talked about this," he told me. "You knew this could happen." A shot of anger surged through me, which caught me by surprise. My father was right. I'd been aware I could lose him and Mommy, maybe, one day, some other time. But as the seasons rolled on and my fear hadn't yet come true, I'd been lulled into thinking it wouldn't happen. Life does that to us. Deep down, we know what may come to pass, but we hope that what we dread can permanently be put off. We convince ourselves it may never occur because if it were going to, it would have already. Then without warning, reality socks you in the face and we realize how foolish it was to believe we'd been spared. And however many years we spent agonizing about what tragedy may come, the sting is no less severe when it does. I knew all along that my folks could be taken, and it still hurt like hell when they actually were. Amelia opened her purse, handed me a tissue, and we all sat down. "So have you been keeping up with your schoolwork?" my father asked. "Yes," I said, gripping the edges of the hard plastic chair so tightly that my knuckles turned white. "Small talk. That's all we can manage in a situation like this." Anything more would involve addressing the gigantic white elephant in the room, the inevitability that we'd soon be forced apart. Since my father didn't have the heart to go there, he initially kept the conversation light. "Have you been eating?" my father asked. I looked over at Amelia. "Yes, everything's good, Puppy," I told him. "I'm sharing a room with Gabby. It's nice." My dad turned to Amelia, who hadn't spoken a word. "Thank you so much for taking her in," he told her. Amelia nodded. "Maria and I appreciate it. We really do. We can never repay you." My father would, however, try. The two agreed that from Colombia he'd send money each month to cover my basic expenses. Papi looked at the floor, then up at me. "I want you to know how badly I feel about all of this," he told me. He sighed deeply. "We have to move forward." His eyes looked tired from lack of sleep. He was scared. Near the end of the visit, my father stood and placed his hands gently on my shoulders and leaned as close as he could to my right ear. "Te amo," he whispered. "I love you. Sé fuerte. Be strong. Don't forget that." He kissed my forehead and backed up a bit before the guards could call him out for getting too close. A bell rang to end our time. All the inmates stood. "No, Papi," I called out, but before I could really flip out, my father shushed me with a hand gesture. Even in prison, he didn't want to cause trouble or bring undue attention to us. Watching my daddy, my beach bud, my friend, walk away in that orange jumpsuit was one of the hardest moments I've ever endured. The ride home was even quieter than the one there. Through mile after mile of freeway, I recalled the years my family spent worrying about this day, the energy we'd expended fearing my parents' arrest,
I now wished we'd set aside the anxiety, refused to let it invade our every interaction, fully enjoyed one another's presence. Instead, we'd allowed ourselves to be robbed twice. We'd trudged through our days with our stomachs in knots, our lives on hold, our hearts in our throat, and yet our worry hadn't changed the outcome. I was still on my way from New Hampshire to Boston, facing a life I never wanted. If there was to be no happily ever after for my family, if we'd find no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, then we should have lived as if the happiness we'd share with one another was itself the prize, the dream, the promised land. Amelia made supper for us that evening, my favorite Colombian stew. I ate it in silence. In the coming weeks, I'd need to write a paper for my history class, help with the chores around Amelia's place, polish my solo for Springfest, return to New Hampshire to visit both my parents, and keep quiet about everything that had just happened. Chapter 8. Left Behind. In every life, there's a turning point. A moment so tremendous, so sharp, and clear that one feels as if one's been hit in the chest, all the breath knocked out, and one knows, absolutely knows, without the merest hint of a shadow of a doubt, that one's life will never be the same. Julia Quinn, novelist. I will always remember that prison waiting room. Hot, crowded, musty. Several rows of attached metal chairs, the kind you see in airports, line the cement walls. On my row, a teenage mother tried to calm down her screaming baby. Two seats over from her, an old man dozed off with his cane at his side. No one spoke. Amelia leaned toward me. "You ready, hun?" she asked. I shrugged. "I guess," I said, although I knew that wasn't true. "I don't think you're ever actually ready to see your own mom locked up, and definitely not when you may never see her again." But I couldn't say that out loud. Not to the one person who'd been willing to take me in. I'd been to a prison when I was small. A few times. My mother took me to an immigration detention center so we could see some neighbors of ours who were fighting deportation. "We need to go lift their spirits," Mommy told me as she fastened the back buttons to my pink cotton dress. "They need us right now." This is going to sound nuts, but I actually look forward to going. The guards were so nice to me. My mother, who knew how much I love sweets, bought me a big chocolate chip cookie from the vending machine. At age 6, the whole experience felt like a fun field trip. At 14, it was the most terrifying day I'd ever faced. The guard, a tall black man with dreads, lumbered into the doorway. "Ladies and gentlemen," he announced. "Sign in and line up here." He held up a clipboard and nodded toward the entrance of the metal detector. The room stirred as the 50 or so people gathered their belongings. "Your bags will be thoroughly searched," he said. "No cell phones are permitted in the visitation area with the detainees."
The detainees?
His words hung there thick and heavy. Just weeks earlier, my mommy had simply been my mommy. The loving mother who combed my long black hair into a ponytail. The mom who had made sure I brushed my teeth and finished my homework. Then, on an afternoon I'd spent a decade wishing I could undo, Mommy had suddenly been labeled an inmate? A prisoner. A detainee. After spending 2 months in the New Hampshire facility where I'd already visited her twice, she'd been moved to this jail in Boston. And in less than an hour, she'd be forced out of the country.
"Take off all of your jewelry," instructed the guard. "And remove any coins from your pockets."
I swiped my fingers through the two back pockets of my jean shorts, empty. I reached up to unfasten my gold necklace, the one my parents had given me for my 10th birthday. I lowered the chain into the guard's plastic bowl and stepped through the detector. Amelia followed. We made our way down a hall
and into a second waiting area, more depressing than the first. The guard rounded the corner into the room. He was holding the clipboard.
"When you hear your name," he barked, "please stand and follow me."
I held my breath as he read off the first name, then the second, then the third, and the fourth. 10 names in, I heard what I'd been listening for, but dreading.
"Diane Guerrero," he announced.
Amelia and I took our places among the others. I felt like I could throw up. The group filed out behind the guard. Halfway down the hall, he stopped in front of the steel door. Above it hung a sign, "Inmate Visitation Area." With the full weight of his right shoulder, the guard leaned into the door and swung it open. He motioned us to walk through. The room smelled like cleaning products. Under fluorescent lights, about 20 inmates sat lined up in booths. Each of them was on a stool behind a gigantic plastic barrier. Every booth had one of those old-school phones in its upper left-hand corner. 5 or 6 guards milled around just watching. As the other visitors scattered to find the prisoners they'd come to see, I stood there and scanned the row, one booth at a time. There, in the middle, I saw Mommy. I walked slowly across the linoleum and slid into a chair facing her. Amelia reached up and handed me the phone. I studied my mother's face. In the 8 weeks since her arrest, she looked like she aged 20 years. She seemed tired and frail, like she hadn't slept for days. I'd never seen her so skinny. Her eyes were glossy, her skin pale. Her hair was disheveled and frizzy and in a messy bun. Her wrists were handcuffed together and resting in her lap. A guard on her side of the barrier placed the phone in her hands. She lifted it to her ear and held it there for a long moment.
"Hello, my princess," she said. Her voice was so soft and feeble that I almost couldn't hear her. "How are you?"
My fingers trembled as I stared at her through the scratched plastic. I promised myself that I wouldn't get choked up, that I'd hold it together for my mom's sake, but I could already feel the tears building up. "I'm okay," I said. I bit down on my lip to keep the tears from escaping. It didn't work.
I'm fine," I stammered. Mommy dropped her head. "Don't cry, baby," she said, her own eyes brimming with tears. "Please, don't cry."
All around the room, different energies collided. To my right, an Indian woman laughed hysterically. To my left, an elderly man who'd been asleep in the waiting room now shouted obscenities. I inched closer to the barrier so I could concentrate.
"I am really sorry about this whole thing," my mom said. "I'm so sorry, Diane."
She didn't mean for her words to sting, but they did. She was sorry. My dad was sorry. The whole world was sorry. But none of it changed my situation. None of it altered the fact that by dusk my childhood would be over, this time for real.
My mother sniffled. "Did you bring the suitcase?" she asked.
I nodded. At the prison's entrance, Amelia had already given the bag to the guards. My mother looked intently at me.
"What are you going to do, Diane?"
It was an odd question for a mother to ask her own young daughter. And yet, it was the one question I'd been preparing to answer since I was a small child. My parents had always had one set of realities. As their citizen daughter, I'd had a very different set. We'd live with the daily worry that we'd eventually have to separate. Our fear was at last coming true. I sat forward in my chair.
"I'm staying, Mommy," I said. "I gotta stay." I'd somehow always known I'd remain. What could I do in Colombia, a place I'd never even been to? What kind of life could I have in a place that my parents had risked everything to escape? Besides that, things were looking good for me for the first time in years. So as far as I was concerned, I didn't have a choice. I needed to stay. "You see that guy?" my mother asked. She tilted her head toward the Dominican-looking guard on my side of the plastic. He must have felt us staring because he looked over at us. "He's a nice guy," she said. I wasn't surprised she'd made friends with the guard. My mother has always been social like that. "You know what he told me?" she asked.
"What?" I said.
She moved the receiver as close to her mouth as she could. "He said immigration only goes after people if they get a tip."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, they're not going around looking for random janitors," she told me. "Someone had to inform them about us."
I gazed at her, but who would have done that?
"I don't know for sure," she told me. She inhaled and then slowly released her breath. "That's why you have to keep your eyes open," she said. "Be very careful, Diane." I started to cry, and this time I didn't hold back. Enormous tears rolled down from my cheeks and dripped from my chin. I pulled up the edge of my t-shirt, and I tried to wipe my face. Amelia, who'd been standing beside me the whole time, began to rub my back. The Dominican guard walked in our direction. "Are you her daughter?" he asked me. I nodded my head, "Yes." "It's okay, sweetheart," he said. "We're not going to hurt your mom." For some reason, that made me cry even louder.
"So why does she have to wear those handcuffs?" I shouted. I could feel myself getting hyped. "Can you take them off? She's not going to do anything."
Several people looked over at me. "I'm sorry, but she has to have those on," he told me. "That's the rules." Soon after, a guard on my mother's side yelled,
"Wrap it up! 5 minutes."
Mommy scooted to the edge of her stool, cradling the receiver between her neck and her shoulder. She put her face right up to the barrier.
"Mi niña, no llores más," she whispered.
She paused, stared down at the floor, and then looked back at me. "Never forget that. I am so proud of you. Be a good girl, okay?" I let go of the receiver and cut my hands over my eyes. There were so many things I needed to tell her. So many words I'd stored away. I wanted to stand up and scream, "My mother is not a criminal! Don't you people understand? You've got the wrong family. Please let her go." But as the phone dangled by its cord, all I could do was wail. "Bye, Mommy," I said between sobs. "Goodbye." Our time was up. When the guard with the dreads gave us the last call, the Indian woman pressed her palms against the plastic, like she was trying to touch the person on the other side. The old man stumbled to his feet, using his cane as leverage. "You ready?" Amelia asked. I stood and pivoted so I could avoid Mommy's face. As much as I'd longed to see her, I also didn't want to remember her like this. Not with her wrists chained up. Not in an orange jumpsuit. The person behind that barrier wasn't my mother. She was a stranger to me. With hardly a sound, the group shuffled back down the corridor. Amelia held my hand while we walked. "This isn't the end for you, Diane," she said as she tried to reassure me. But it felt like the end. As devastated as I was for my mom, I was even more scared for myself. She and my dad were going home to family. I was stepping into a future I'd prayed would never come. Outside, Amelia peered out over the lot, trying to recall where she'd parked her Camry. A few hundred feet from us, near the prison side entrance, a white police van pulled up. Amelia and I exchanged a look. Seconds later, two guards herded some inmates onto the curb. My mother was among them. Just as my mother was stepping into the paddy wagon, she turned and caught a glimpse of me. She froze. I could tell she wanted to say something, to run to me. But before she could make a move, a guard rushed her into the van,
Let's go, he snapped.
The engine rumbled on. From her seat in the rear, Mommy twisted herself around so she could see me through the bars on the windows. She was trying to tell me something, but I couldn't figure out what it was. Then all at once, I understood. I love you, she was mouthing. I love you. I love you. I love you. She repeated the three words until the van turned from the lot and disappeared. I smiled. That was the one thing I could be sure of. My mother loved me. Fuck anyone who tried to come between that. The summer I lost my parents, it was the strangest kind of heartache. No friends gathered to grieve over the departed. No flowers were sent. No memorial service was planned. And yet the two people I cherished the most were gone. Not gone from the world itself, but gone from me. We'd find a way to move forward, to carry on, just not with the promise of one another's presence. With all of my heart, I wanted to reverse time, rewind the months, go back to those days warm and innocent when I felt safe, when the smell of Mommy's freshly cooked rice and plantains greeted me at our front door, when the sound of Papi's laughter made me feel like the most precious girl in the world, when everything still made sense. But I couldn't go back. The only way out was ahead. Amelia spotted her car in the lot. On the drive to her house, I stared from my window in silence. My mother's warning, the haunting admonition, echoed through me. Be careful. Be careful. Be careful. Tomorrow, I'd begin a new life, one uncertain and frightening. A makeshift family, a different home, a path I prayed so hard I'd never end up taking. I glanced over at Amelia, settled back into my seat, and watched the sun descend over Boston Harbor. Chapter 9. Second Family. If you go anywhere, even paradise, you'll miss your home. Malala Yousafzai, Pakistani activist and 2014 Nobel Peace Prize recipient. On the afternoon my father was deported, I didn't get to visit him. Immigration officials hadn't told us exactly when they'd send him off. And since they deported him in the middle of a workday, Amelia couldn't take me to the detention center. I was relieved to miss the final meeting. Seeing my parents with their spirits broken, their heads dropped, had brought almost more sorrow than my heart could hold. Following any loss, there comes a moment when you shift from mourning. If you continue to linger in the grief, you couldn't function. So a little at a time, you create a so-called new normal. Although there's nothing normal about it. With a gaping hole in your life, you move on. And it's impossible to do that if you keep peeking over your shoulder. I needed to look ahead. Amelia was wonderful to me. She and Gabby and her other two children, both of whom were in their 20s, made me feel a part of the family. They were beyond hospitable. And yet, I knew I was a guest. Mi casa es su casa, any polite Latino host will tell you. But everyone understands the truth. Remaining welcome means abiding by the rules. I found it hard to relax. I had this nagging fear that I might do something to get myself thrown out. Amelia didn't hint at such a thing, but I, aware of the major sacrifice she was making to have me there, became vigilant about respecting boundaries. Perfect example. I minimized the space I took up. I stuffed my few belongings into a couple bottom drawers and one area of the closet. I stored my toiletries inside a travel bag rather than on the sink top or in the shower. With five people in the house, things were already cramped. I didn't want to make Amelia or her children regret their choice to take me in. I also recognized how much responsibility she had as a single parent and as a hard-working nurse's assistant. I did all that I could to lighten her load. I'd been around Amelia's home so much that I'd caught on to the way she ran things. Without her having to ask, I helped with the chores. Each time I used a plate, I washed it,
dried it, and put it in the cabinet. While I was with my parents, I'd been going through a no-meat phase. I got over that real fast. A permanent boarder can't be picky. I mean, I'm still pretty picky, but maybe less so because of my experience, which in retrospect is probably a good thing. My parents had babied me when it came to food. Between meals, Gabriella would sometimes grab a snack from the fridge. I got Amelia's permission before I ate anything. "You know," Gabriella would tease me, "you don't have to ask my mom every time." But I was reluctant to be so free. She was the daughter, I was the company. She could get away with things I wouldn't try. I was so mindful of not rocking the boat that you could imagine how upset I was if somehow I did. Several weeks into my stay, Gabriella pulled me aside. "Can I talk to you for a sec?" she asked. "Sure," I said, my throat tightened. "I know you don't mean for this to happen," she continued, "but my sister has been finding a lot of your hair in the bathroom." I wrinkled my forehead. "My hair?" I said. "Yep," she answered. "It sheds." "Before you leave the bathroom, can you please clean it up?"
Okay, I said, the tears welling up.
"I'm so sorry, Gabby. I'll promise I'll do that." From then on, I was OCD about my hair, which was immediately identifiable as mine since I was the only one with a straight, long black mane. After untangling my tresses, I'd thoroughly wipe down the sink and pick up every single strand. At Amelia's place, cash was tight. Papi sent Mommy as promised. He'd gotten a friend to sell his and Mommy's cars. That cash, coupled with his lotto windfall, had to be split between providing for me and settling into his new life. If Amelia gave me a few dollars, I held on to it. I could make $50 last for weeks. I loved being able to buy small things for myself. If I wanted a bottle of juice or something from the drugstore, I could pay for it without having to involve Amelia. I was smart and careful about my purchases, which pretty much limited me to buying tampons and dollar pizza. I couldn't wait to turn 16 and get a job. Financial independence. That's what I wanted to create. While many girls my age were poring over fashion magazines or giggling about crushes, I was figuring out how I was going to make it on my own. My parents' deportation had thrust me headfirst into the world of adult worries. Mommy and Papi vanished from my life at a critical juncture, as I was navigating that tricky passage between early and middle adolescence. My relationship with my parents had been changing. One minute I wanted to be with them, the next I was pushing them aside to hang with my pals. But once I no longer had access to them, I longed for the simplest experiences with them, like watching a silly movie with Papi, or having Mommy bring me a cup of hot tea when I had cramps. In my mother's absence, I learned to pop an Advil and keep it moving. And although Amelia tried to fill in, it wasn't quite the same. I missed my parents most on one night in particular, Springfest. I'd nearly decided to pull out of the duet. I was so shaken up about my parents' arrest, I didn't know if I could get myself together. Then again, I didn't want to disappoint Mr. Stewart or Damien. I owed it to myself to go out there and do it. We'd worked hard. It would have been a shame to let our song go unsung. The night of the concert rolled around. Amelia and Gabriella came to support me. So did Sabrina and her mom, Eva. "Dude, you're going to be fantastic," Gabriella told me before I went backstage. "We'll be cheering you on." The show was filled with various performances, from opera, jazz, and contemporary to string ensemble and choral pieces. Everyone had a part in this thing. It was the one time of the year we could show our parents what we'd been working so hard at. Mr. Stewart gave Damien and me our cue, and we strode to our microphones. I peered out across the audience. It was packed with parents, teachers, administrators, people from the community. Even as I was about to perform, I was pinching myself that I'd been chosen. Damien delivered his opening lines beautifully. Then came my turn. I closed my eyes. "In a world that's moving too fast," I sang softly. "In a world where nothing can last, I will hold you."
I will hold you. I was so nervous that my voice shook, and the words that I'd practiced over and over now suddenly seemed new, different. So stay with me and hold me tight, we sang in unison, and dance with me like it's the last night of the world. At the close of our piece, the room erupted in applause. Damien and I linked arms and bowed. I peered out again over the scores of faces, praying that, by some miracle, I'd spot Mommy and Poppy. Amid the bright lights and magic of that stage, the impossible seemed possible, even for the briefest of moments. Yet, off the stage, with the curtains lowered and the auditorium empty, the cold truth remained. My parents, who for weeks had awaited their fate in a pair of New Hampshire jail cells, had already been sent to their homeland a world away. I'd never been to Colombia, yet, in a way, I felt like I'd gone a dozen times. That's because my parents kept Eric and me connected to their homeland. They played the music, prepared the foods, told us stories from their childhoods. We also talked frequently to our many aunts and uncles and cousins there, and over the years, a few visited us. But in our culture, it doesn't matter if you've never met family. They are blood, and therefore, you are connected by something greater. I didn't have to see my relatives to know they cared for me. Their love came through over the phone and in the birthday cards and letters they always mailed us. Even still, since I hadn't actually set foot in their country, it remained kind of a mystery to me. That changed in July 2001. About 3 months after he'd returned to Palmira, Papi arranged for me to spend a month with him there. In the days leading up to my departure, I was eager and, yes, a bit apprehensive. How would it feel to see my parents again? What would their living conditions be? And was it safe there? As soon as my relatives heard I was coming, they began putting in requests for me to bring items that were hard to get or doubly expensive in Palmira, such as Victoria's Secret lotion and Snickers candy bars. Keep a close eye on your bags, Bubby warned me. People steal. As if my blood pressure wasn't already high enough, Bubby hit me with some tough news a week before takeoff. Your mother and I have decided to separate, he told me. I pressed the phone closer to my ear. My heartbeat sped up. What are you talking about, Bubby? We no longer are speaking to each other, he said. When you come here, you can spend time with each of us. But don't expect us to do things together. I nearly dropped the phone. All the bickering, the blaming each other for their circumstances, had threatened my parents' connection for years. Deportation had apparently been the final blow. Once in Colombia, they went their separate ways. Mommy moved in with her brother. Papi stayed with his sister. They lived minutes away from each other, but emotionally, they were worlds apart. This trip was beginning to sound like one I'd rather not take. I set out for Palmira on the eve of my 15th birthday. Be careful, Amelia told me as she dropped me off at Logan. And call me once you're there. The flight from Boston to Cali's Alfonso Bonilla Aragon, the closest international airport to my parents' region, is long. Very, especially if you throw in a layover in Miami. And especially if you're uncertain of what you'll face upon landing. Mommy and Papi had told me they'd meet me in the airport lounge. What they failed to mention is that they'd bring company. Oh, my lord. When I entered the lounge, the band began playing a loud song. Oh, no. Please don't let that be for me, I thought. Please don't let that be for me. Yes! My mother had hired a full band to celebrate my arrival. Balloons, flowers, and a sign that read, Welcome to Colombia, Diane, filled the waiting area. Several members of my extended family, as well as a bunch of neighbors my mom had rounded up, cheered, called out my name, and snapped random photos of me. I was so stunned that I couldn't speak. I met eyes with Mommy and Papi, both of whom were waving madly at me. My look of astonishment probably spoke volumes. I wanted to scream,
What the hell is all of this?
Instead, I put on a half smile. After all, it's not every day you get serenaded. The whole thing was pretty funny. Well, sort of.
You're here! Mommy shrieked.
She rushed toward me with a hug. Puppy stood aside as we embraced, and then he leaned in and kissed me on the forehead. Hello, Chivola, he said. I'm glad you made it. Meanwhile, the band played on. People I didn't know pushed bouquets into my hands. Finally, we all made our way out the sliding doors and into the sauna. The humidity immediately turned my straight hair into a puffy Colombian fro. First stop, a party at my aunt's place. Among the caravan of cars, my uncle drove Mommy and me there. As you know by now, my mother can be chatty. But on this day, she was completely wound up. She hurled question after question at me. How's Amelia? She asked. Before I could answer, she was on the next topic.
Did you bring the lotion and all the other gifts for the family? How did Spring Fest turn out?
I sat dazed and silent. I couldn't believe I was in Colombia. I'd always thought I'd come here for the first time with my folks, once they'd been granted citizenship. Once nuestra situación had at last been settled. Everything happened so quickly. One night I was cheering with Papi over his lucky win. The next night my parents were wearing orange, and now I was standing in the nation they'd once escaped. A serious whirlwind. I stared from my window. In downtown Cali, locals on their bikes weaved in and out of traffic. A lot of motorcycles and old cars. Models I hadn't seen in America honked and switched lanes without signaling. Teen girls strutted by in booty-hugging dresses. Some girls wore tiny midriff bearing stretch tops and jeans that barely covered their butt cracks. Music rang out from all directions. Then, on the road into Palmira, throngs of barefooted children begged. When we stopped at an intersection, some of the kids wandered right up to our car and pleaded for money or food. Many were juggling limes, trying to earn cash from passersby. Mommy, why are there so many children on the streets? I asked. My mother sighed. Dayan, they're homeless, she told me. Where are their parents? I asked. I don't know, she told me. My eyes filled with tears. I couldn't imagine what it would be like for a 5 or 7-year-old child to be left on their own. The entire scene was chaotic, colorful, exotic, wild. And because of the straight-up poverty, it was also a bit unsettling. In the States, I hadn't witnessed that kind of hardship. I was struck with the realization, this could have been my life, OMG. Would I have been juggling little limes too? WTF. This is not okay. What's going on? Save the children! We pulled up to the house. My aunt and a slew of excited relatives filed out of the front door to greet us. Among the faces, I saw Eric. I lit up. I hadn't expected to see my brother because I heard he was away in Santa Marta, a city in northern Colombia. He'd come home early. How are you, sis? He said, picking me up and twirling me. You're so big now! I'm good, I said shyly, probably because I hadn't seen him in so long. He looked different. Better. His face was clean-shaven. His complexion bright. During his first month in Colombia, he struggled to find his way. He floated from one family member's home to the next. But he eventually found work as an English teacher. On the day of our reunion, he seemed happy. After a bash that went on for hours, Mommy and I left for her place. I'd stay with her first. Both of my parents' homes were in working-class areas. Many of the residents had only cold water. You had to be wealthy to afford hot. Rows of cookie-cutter homes, most made from adobe, were as basic can get. No bells, no whistles, no fancy interiors. Come on in, Mommy said as we walked through the door of my grandfather's house. Make yourself comfortable. I rolled in my suitcase, set it aside, and began glancing around. I followed my mother into a rear bedroom. There, she shared a tiny space with my young cousin. He slept on the top bunk,